OU Israel presents.
Come in. Welcome.
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky. This show is for Parshat Shofetim. It is, at first recording and broadcast, Thursday, Yom Chamishi, Bet Elul, Tovshin Samach Zayin. On the secular calendar, it is the 16th of August, Thursday. It is the first day of the championship play of Israel Baseball League. Yesterday was the end of the regular season. Beit Shemesh Blue Sox finished in first place, so they get the pennant, I guess. All six teams are participating in the championships. Today are the quarterfinals, with the number 3 and the number 6 team playing. That would be Modi'in against Petach Tikva. And the 4th and 5th team, that would be Ranana and Netanya. I don't remember which one is 4th and which is 5th. But they'll be playing. The winner of the 3-6 game plays Tel Aviv, the second place team, tomorrow. The winner of the 4-5 game plays Beit Shemesh, the number 1 team, tomorrow. And the two winners of tomorrow's games will be playing on Sunday for the championship. This Israel Baseball League update was brought to you by Torah Tidbits, a supporter of Israel Baseball League because they are Shomer Shabbat, I think the only sport, professional sport in Israel, that does not play and practice on Shabbat. And we also support them because they have taken away the last excuse for American Jews not coming on Aliyah. I would say to Jews in the States, how come you don't come on Aliyah? Don't you want to live in Israel? Don't you want to bring up your family in Israel? Don't you think that's where all Jews should be? And their answer is very often, yeah, but baseball. How do I not have baseball? So guess what? They have baseball here too. True, not major league level, but as many Americans who came to games over the summer have said, it's an awful lot cheaper to come see an Israel Baseball League game than it is to see a Major League Baseball game in the States. Obviously, the above was said with a bit of tongue-in-cheek, but I sort of got into it, and now that the season is almost over, it's kind of sad, but they have announced that they'll be back again next summer. And we look forward to it. A lot of American Olim have gone to games, and you could just see them smiling with starting the game with the singing of the national anthem, HaTikva, rather than the Star Spangled Banner, but still the national anthem, and seeing a piece of Americana being transported to Israel with its own Israeli touches. And it's been a lot of fun. When I told one of my daughters that I was going to yet another game, I won't tell you how many I've been to, it's a little, whatever the word is, I don't know. She said, Daddy, what are you trying to make up for 25 years? And I thought for maybe a half a moment and said, yeah, I guess so. And that's how a lot of people felt. So, Israel Baseball League, we thank you, and all the strength and success, and we'll see you again. Tehillim Kuf Lamed, Psalm 130. Shir Hama'alot Mima'amakim Kraticha Adonai. Adonai Shimavakoli, Tihieno Aznecha Kashuvot Lakol Tachanunai. Imavonot Tishmorya Adonai Miya Amod, Ki Imacha Hasalicha Lama'an Tivare. Kiviti Adonai Kiveta Nafshi Velidvaroho Cholti. Nafshi Ladonai, Mishomerim Laboker, Shomerim Laboker. Yachel Yisrael El Adonai, Ki Im Adonai HaChesed V'Harbe Imo Fedut. Zehu yichdeh et Yisrael mikol avonotav. Achenu kol beit Yisrael hanatunim batzara uvashivya haomedim bein bayam uvein bayabasha. Hamakom yirachem aleihem v'yotzieim mitzara lirvacha umeafela laora umishibud lugeula hashta ba'agala uvizman kariv v'nomar amen. And now please join me in a mini shiur that I gave yesterday to the Torah Tidbits folders. As I've said many times, you, the listenership of Torah Tidbits Audio, are part in spirit of that group of folders. I know that if you were in Yerushalayim and at the Israel Center, you would actually join in, fold a couple of Torah Tidbits, and hear the Divrei Torah and the Shiurim. But if not, you get a chance to listen to some of them on Torah Tidbits Audio. Here it is. Parshat Shoftim, which you're really supposed to say Shofetim, but hurts my tongue when I say that. Parshat Shoftim has at least three different types of authority that are presented to the Jewish people, and we have to look at them not only in what they are in theory, but look at the track record as well. For example, you have the topic of king. Som tasim alecha melech. You choose a king when you get into Eretz Yisrael according to God's goral, etc., etc. And there are rules and regulations that kings have to follow. There are rules and regulations that people have to follow vis-a-vis a king. And that's one form of authority. But now, look at the track record. Open up Tanakh and see good kings and bad kings, and kings that the Tanakh describes as never reached the level of David HaMelech, or was like David HaMelech, except didn't get rid of Avodah Zorah, or didn't do that. And you had good kings that were fantastic, and good kings that were not so effective. And you had bad kings, and you had worse kings. You had a king who served for 55 years, the longest reign of any king in Israel. Menashe was his name. And the stories that the Gemara tells us about Menashe, bad news. Very bad news. Like, who needs a king if that's what a king behaves like for 55 years on the throne? I must say parenthetically that there's a story in the Gemara about a rabbi that was giving a shiur, and he said something put-downy about Menashe, which sort of is like what I just did. But he said something worse about Menashe. And that night, he had a dream, and Menashe HaMelech appeared to him in a dream and answered for him a very difficult question that he had in his own learning. And the guy in his dream says to Menashe, I'm shocked. I mean, from what I read in the Tanakh about you, I'm shocked that you could come up with such a brilliant solution to a problem I was having in Mishnah or Gemara. And how could you have been so evil? And his answer was, if you lived in my generation, you would have been right on my tailcoat. Meaning, you don't judge from generation to generation, and certainly not with the hindsight of thousands of years. But it's a problem. I would say the scorecard for a king is not so great till today, and yet we keep looking towards the future of the coming of Melech HaMashiach, which means the restoration of a kingship, which in its best form is fantastic. So it comes with, yes, we want a king, but we don't want the bad ones that Tanakh tells us about. We want it to be the ideal kind of situation. You have another form of authority in the Sedra, and that is a prophet, a Navi. And there you have discussion of Navi Emet, a true prophet, and Navi Sheker, a false prophet. A false prophet who says things that he makes up on his own in God's name. A false prophet that speaks in the name of an Avodah Zarah. And the devastation throughout Tanakh from false prophets almost makes you wonder what benefit we had from the true prophets. Again, with hindsight, we're glad we had a Moshe Rabbeinu and a Shmuel and a Navi and a Yeshayahu and a Yecheskel and a Yirmiyahu and all the other good prophets. But at the time, it was a what's the mixed blessing kind of thing. Because in the field of relying on prophecy, having a prophet means you have to listen to him. Listening to a prophet is a risky venture unless you know that it's a true prophet. How do you know it's a true prophet? You give him a test. And if he passes that test, and he has the personal qualities of a prophet, and he says things that prophets are supposed to say, then you could count on the fact that he is a true prophet to the point where you have to follow him even if he says, for example, this Shabbat, I want you all to get into cars and buses and meet me up in Kiryat Shmona. And if he says this is a Hora'at Sha'ah, it is an emergency situation for this Shabbat only, and he says, Ko Amar Hashem, thus says God, you have to do it. Ad Kedei Kach, so much so that I think Rambam puts it like this. An old man who's been religious and, you know, pious all his life, who's told by a Navi who has the credentials of being a true prophet that he must violate a Shabbat. And he says to himself, I know that I'm supposed to listen to the Navi, but I can't do it. I have never violated Shabbat in my entire life. I'm now 87 years old, and since my memory serves me, I've always kept Shabbat. I can't do it. That person who refuses, with the goal of Shmirat Shabbat, to listen to the Navi, is subject to a death penalty from heaven. You have to listen to a Navi. Otherwise, the system doesn't work. Now, on that score, we are to blame a little bit in that. When God communicated directly with Bnei Yisrael, we panicked and we said, please, I don't want to hear God's voice anymore. You, Moshe, tell us what God wants and we'll do it. God says, okay, you're on. It's a deal. The deal is, I will cause among you to arise from your brethren true prophets, and you have to listen to them. Because that's your choice. You didn't want to listen, God says, to my voice. I understand, and I even approve of the system that you are now going to have. But you can't get rid of that either. And how many times do we read in Tanakh about masses of Jews who didn't listen to the prophets? And how many times do we hear about them following false prophets? So that's a form of authority that definitely has its two sides to it. And it's a mixed blessing unless you've got the right people. And that means the prophets themselves and the receivers of prophecy, people with the right attitude and know what they're supposed to do. Okay. Third authority, which is actually mentioned first in the Sedra, is rabbinic authority. Rabbinic authority in the form of Sanhedrin, primarily, and now that we're between Sanhedrins, even though there's a movement to reconstruct it, we're technically between Sanhedrins, we do have the concept of rabbinic authority. And yet the Torah carries a warning. The warning is called Zakein Mamre. A Zakein Mamre is a Rav with proper smicha, with proper authority to pasken halacha, who paskins, meaning issues a rabbinic decree, against the decree of the Sanhedrin. Now, it's a very unusual, it's even more than unusual, according to our sources, it never actually happened that it went as far as I'm going to describe it to you now. A Zakei Mamre is supposed to be brought up on charges of going against the Sanhedrin with his psak by his town's court. And they haul him into court and they say, we have witnesses that testify that you paskin, that you are allowed to kosher liver in a microwave oven. Yet the Sanhedrin has already declared that you may not kosher livers in a microwave oven. Now, if this example is not an accurate one, both historically, it doesn't matter because there's a future there also with microwaves. Getting a Sanhedrin does not mean we get rid of microwave ovens. So when you talk of anything modern in context of Sanhedrin, it's not yet happening, but it will. But there's another thing that might not be accurate because it depends on what type of Sanhedrin decree that this Zakei Mamre is contradicting. Anyway, witnesses testify, and his court in his town issue a decree that he is forbidden to express that psak halacha. He's not allowed to follow it, and he's not allowed to tell people to follow it because it goes against the psak of the Sanhedrin. Let's say he disregards the court's instructions, and he continues to paskin against the Sanhedrin. The court in his town that he has defied brings him up on charges to a court in Yerushalayim, a lower court in Yerushalayim. And they go through the whole schmear, the witnesses testifying and that and that and that. And that court declares to him, you may not put forth that psak halacha, etc., etc. And he defies it again. The sources say it goes to the next higher court and then eventually gets to the Sanhedrin Gedola of 71, Sanhedrin Hagadol of 71 judges. And if they hear a case of Zakein Mamre, and they paskin that he's not allowed to say what he's saying, and he continues to do it, he's liable to a death penalty. That's heavy stuff. The Gemara says it's never happened. It really can't be expected to ever happen, because of how many steps you have to go through. Guy has to be a total idiot to run a risk of a death penalty and defy a Sanhedrin like that. And so whether it happens or not, it's there to teach us how serious we're talking about rabbinic authority in the Sanhedrin. Now, we've lost a lot of this because we don't have a Sanhedrin, and we have, my rabbi said you could do this. Oh, well, my rabbi said it's all right to do that. My rabbi said you're not allowed to do that. Now, just coming into Shemitah year, you've got, my rabbi says you could use the Heter Mechira, and my rabbi says you have to go to the Badatz, and my rabbi says you have to do Otsar Beitin, v'chulei, v'chulei, v'chulei. So, you know, any issue, there are people who open a refrigerator as long as the light that goes on in it has been turned off, regardless of whether the refrigerator is running or not. There are other people who paskin that you have to wait until you hear the refrigerator active, you listen to hear the motor, and then you're allowed to open the door, but when it's quiet, you can't, because you might activate. There are others that say you can't even do that, but you have to set a Shabbos clock to turn it on and off. Now, one of those people is saying your opinion is not only wrong, but it's violating Shabbat. And that one says to the other one, no, you're unnecessarily strict. And he says to the other one, you're violating Shabbat. And that one says, no, you're both unnecessarily strict, and this is an acceptable point of view. That doesn't exist with a Sanhedrin. With a Sanhedrin, on one of the days, and this I anticipate in a future Sanhedrin, sometime on their agenda, you could be sure it's not the first day or two of their deliberations, they're going to come up with the topic of opening refrigerators on Shabbat, opening soda bottles on Shabbat, how to handle Shemitah, what's kosher, what's not kosher, what's considered cooking, what's considered not cooking, all of these questions, because Sanhedrin, even though I used it already an example of a judiciary role, Sanhedrin is mostly legislative. They make halacha. They clarify halacha. That's legislative. They also have jurisdiction over a few very special kind of cases. They do not handle, for example, murder cases. That's a court of 23. What goes to the Senate, just like the Supreme Court, Lahavdil, the Supreme Court of the United States doesn't handle murder cases. They handle only what eventually gets up to the Supreme Court going through a whole bunch of lower courts and procedures. So you've got Zakein Mamre is one, Navi Sheker, a false prophet, is brought to the Sanhedrin of 71. And by the way, you could see in there that the Torah recognizes that a Navi Sheker, a false prophet, is a really tough situation, because he could be someone who's very charismatic, and he could be someone who has a large following and a passionate following, and you just don't go and say, hey, you're a Navi Sheker, I'm not going to listen to you. But taking him to the highest Sanhedrin carries clout, etc., etc. So forms of authority have their potential drawbacks. I would say, objectively, that the rabbinic authority has the least problems compared with the king and the prophet. And that's good for us, because that's the one that survived more than the king and the prophet. We don't have kings today, we don't have prophets, but we do have rabbinic authority, albeit not as focused as the Sanhedrin and many ramifications thereof. But what it also means is you have to have a tremendous amount of faith, confidence, trust in the Sanhedrin and in the king and in the kahuna and in Navi. And we had periods in Jewish history where this was used against us. You had situations in the time of the second Beit HaMikdash, towards the end of its tenure, where the Sanhedrin was reliably Torah true. The kahuna, the functioning kahuna in the Beit HaMikdash, was notably not halachic. It's where the Greeks appointed the people that they wanted on purpose to always give a headache to the Sanhedrin, besides money, to give a headache to Sanhedrin. Well, one of the clever conquerors' ploy is to make the people so busy fighting each other that they won't decide, hey, you know, it'd be a good idea to rebel against our oppressors. It just couldn't happen because we couldn't pull our act together.
You are listening to Torah Tidbits Audio, either on Israel National Radio or on OU Radio, or both. And if you continue listening, you shall hear a lovely song.
Oh, HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Sholoi Malei Ze Malachei Yashor Ez Malachei Elyoin Mimelech Malchei HaMelochim Oloi HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Boyachem Sholoi Malachei Yashor
was Shalom Aleichem by a recording star named Ohad from an album called O2. And even though I grew up with the traditional Shalom Aleichem, you know, Shalom Aleichem, Malachei Ashoharet, I still sing that traditional one, but I do enjoy hearing different versions of Shalom Aleichem. When any of my children are home, invariably we will mix the traditional with some of the newer tunes. If you follow the custom of singing Shalom Aleichem each stanza three times, you've got time to introduce some new melodies, but it's nice to retain the traditional one as well. In any event, Torah Tidbits Audio is a Erev Shabbat kind of show. Even though it's first broadcast on Thursday, people are already into the Shabbat preparing mode, and certainly those who listen to it on Friday should have something to help them into that Shabbat mood. And what better way is there than the song Shalom Aleichem? I'd like you now to listen to a different, even smaller mini shiur that I gave the folders today. After they had all finished, a few of them stuck around, and I shared what I think is a very important concept that comes right out of this week's Torah reading. Please listen, and then I will say a few more things about it afterwards. Mitzvah in the Torah to count the Omer, Shene Emar, as it says, Usfartem Lochem. We actually say that in the introduction. Hineni Muchon Mezuman, and I'm Shen, Kemosha Katuv Batorah, and we say it. There are mitzvot we don't necessarily say, Hineni Muchon Mezuman, but they also come from the Torah. Leishev Basuka is a mitzvah from the Torah, Shen Emar, Basuko Teshvu Shivat Yamim. In fact, on the first night, there is a Yehi Ratzon and a Ribono Shel Olam and a Hineni Muchon Mezuman that quotes that pasuk. Whether you say something before the mitzvah or not is not the issue. The issue is, it's a mitzvah from the Torah, and there's the chapter and verse that commands it. When you have such a mitzvah, we often say the bracha. Blessed is God, our God, King of the universe, Asher kiddushanu b'mitzvotav, who sanctifies us with his mitzvot, v'tzivanu, and commands us on such and such. Whether it's affixing a mezuzah, putting on the tefillin, or whatever, that's the way it works. The phrase becomes a very special one, Asher kiddushanu b'mitzvotav, God who sanctifies us with his mitzvot and commanded us so and so. The question then that jumps out at you, if you think about it, is how can we say such a bracha on Chanukah candles? Asher kiddushanu b'mitzvotav, God who sanctifies us with his mitzvot and commanded us lahadlik ner shel Chanukah. Here's a chumash. You look at it from the beginning till the end. You do not find the command to light Chanukah candles. You do find the command to eat matzah at the Seder. You find the command to put on tefillin. You find the command to say Birkat HaMazon. Those are all mitzvot in the Torah. But Chanukah candles is not from the Torah. Megillat Esther on Purim is not from the Torah. Those are post-biblical. So how can we say the bracha, Asher kiddushanu b'mitzvotav v'tzivanu, talking about God? That's the question. It's a famous question. Do you recall the question? Do you know the answer? The answer is in this week's Sedra, and it's a very, very significant mitzvah and concept because of how many people disregard it. The Torah commands us to follow the dictates of the Sanhedrin through the generations, and not to veer from what they tell us, neither to the right nor to the left. In other words, in Parshat Shofetim, there is a mitzvah aseh called, actually, ta'aseh, thou shalt do, and that's preceded by the words, al pi ha-Torah asher yaruch, according to the teachings that they shall teach you, and according to the things which they shall say, you shall do, ta'aseh. Ta'aseh is a command. And then, lo tasur. Lo tasur means do not veer from what they teach you, neither to the right nor to the left. So the nickname of the two mitzvot that we're talking about, two among the 613, are ta'aseh, that's the positive command, and lo tasur, that's the prohibition against disregarding what our sages and the Sanhedrin tell us. Therefore, since the Sanhedrin commanded us to light Chanukah candles on the eight nights of Chanukah, we are not only required to do so, but the authority behind it is so powerful that Chazal said, go ahead and say the same formula bracha which you use for Torah commands for this too, because in essence it's a Torah command. They commanded it, the Torah commands you to listen to them, therefore the Torah commanded it. That's remember that from Mass. If A is equal to B, and B is equal to C, then A is equal to C. Remember what that's called? Transitive property,
that's,
I think.
No, that's not Bernie.
Transitive property. So, if the Torah commands us to listen to the Sanhedrin, and the Sanhedrin commands us to light the Chanukah candles, it is tantamount to the Torah commanding us to light Chanukah candles. Therefore, we can say the bracha, Asher kiddushanu b'mitzvotav v'tzivanu, and God commanded us lahadlik ner shel Chanukah. So too with Al Mikra Megillah, so too with Al Netilat Yodayim. The only people the Torah commanded to wash their hands and feet before doing avoda in the Beit HaMikdash of the Kohanim. The Torah did not command us to wash our hands before we make hamotzi. The rabbis did. But the Torah commanded us to listen to the rabbis, and therefore, in essence, the Torah commanded us to listen, to wash our hands. Same thing with the saying of Hallel, same thing with the making of an Eruv, and the lighting of Shabbos candles. Those are the mitzvot, which are rabbinic, which we see, I was going to say which we elevate, we didn't elevate it. We see them elevated to the status of Torah-like command, ad kedekach, how much so, that the bracha is the same for any Torah mitzvah. Now the flip side of the coin. Well, how could that be if the Torah has previously commanded us twice, once in Parshat Vayetchanan and once in Re'eh, not to add to the Torah? The Torah has 613 mitzvot. I just told you a whole bunch of others, like the lighting of Hanukkah candles, that seems to be an addition to the Torah, which is not allowed. So the answer is, no, it's not a Torah law, it's a rabbinic law. Aha! If it's a rabbinic law, and that's saving you from it being a violation of adding to the Torah, then what was I telling you, that it's really tantamount to being a Torah law, which means it's tantamount to adding to the Torah. Therefore, of necessity, we'll have to say that the rabbis will never be able to legislate something of equal status to Torah law, because that will be a violation of adding to the Torah. They will always have the authority to legislate rabbinic law, which is one notch below Torah law, but it's the command in the Torah that brings it up to that one notch below. I'm just using that as sort of an image. In other words, rabbinic law would be far below Torah law had it not been for the fact that the Torah commands us to listen to rabbinic law, which elevates it almost but not quite Torah law, because otherwise we'd be encroaching on the other Torah law not to add to the Torah, and that would create a distortion of Torah. So we see that there are certain guidelines that apply to rabbinic law, even though the Torah gives the authority behind it to make it like Torah law, that always make them different. For example, safek. When you have a doubt of a pure Torah mitzvah, you have to be machmir. You have to take the strict measure. Safek d'oraita, it's called, l'chumra. When it comes to rabbinic law, they purposely said, when it comes to rabbinic law, apply safek d'rabbanan l'kula. That was one of the measures that they put in to the guidelines for following rabbinic law, to make sure that nobody considers it equal to Torah law, thereby encroaching on the requirement that the Torah not be added to. In other words, if you'll say, so what's the difference? I have to eat matzah and I have to light Hanukkah candles. True. And they're both obligatory. True. And as a good Jew, I have to do them both. True. So what's the difference? The difference is essential. Essentially, this is a Torah law. Essentially, this is a Torah-backed rabbinic law. And if you feel that the logic is not totally with this, too bad. Doesn't have to. There's no guarantee that it's going to be logical. But it has a power behind it of the Torah, based on this week's Torah reading of those two psukim, Deuteronomy 17:11, I like to quote, and you could go look it up. And that is the Torah's grandfather clause, the elastic clause in the Torah that gives Torah authority to rabbinic law, and it emphasizes to the rabbis and judges, Asher Yihyeh Bayomim Hohem, who will be in your time. Meaning, don't expect a level of legislation of Moshe Rabbeinu or of the early Sanhedrin, because then it paralyzes the system. Then your generation will say, well, our rabbis are certainly not on the level that they used to be, so maybe we don't have to listen to them. Comes the Torah and emphasizes, these are the ones you've got. You do not have the previous generation except access to their works. But these are the ones, and this Sanhedrin is the one that has the authority, with the guidelines that Sanhedrin has to follow, and when they're allowed to overrule a previous Sanhedrin or not overrule a previous Sanhedrin, those are details. But the power is there, and to me it pulls the rug out from under those Jews who say, well, I'm not that religious. I of course keep the Torah. But the rabbis sort of went a little overboard and they made all of these laws and I don't do them. Too bad. Because the Torah says you got to do those. If you kvetch about waiting 6 hours after eating meat before you could drink milk, or 3 hours if that's your custom or whatever, then and you want to dismiss it as a rabbinic law that's, you know, mugzam, exaggerated, you have to always be accountable to the Torah that gives the authority for later generations to say, not only can't you cook milk and meat together, but you can't eat them together even if they're not cooked, and you don't bring them onto the same table, and you even have to wait a period of time after you eat meat before you could drink milk. That is not Torah law, but it's backed up by Torah law. So, which one of the 613 mitzvot tells us we have to do these things? Ta'aseh. Which one of the Torah mitzvot tells us you're not allowed to do X, Y, and Z if it's rabbinic? Lo tasur. So they're both there as one grand positive command and one grand prohibition in the Torah, this week's Sedra.
I feel I need to clarify something for intellectual honesty, and it's important also. The Torah's command of V'asita al pi hadavar asher yagidu lecha, and you shall do according to what they tell you, is specifically min hamakom hahu asher yivchar Hashem, from that place which God will choose, referring to Yerushalayim, referring to the Sanhedrin that sits there. V'shamarta la'asot kechol asher yorucha, and you shall be meticulous to observe and preserve all that they teach you. Al pi ha-Torah asher yorucha, according to the Torah which they teach you, instruct you, v'al ha-mishpat asher yomeru lecha, ta'aseh, thou shalt do that which they tell you, lo tasur min ha-davar asher yagidu lecha yomin u'smol. These are the two verses that I referred to earlier. These are the two commands, one positive, one of the 248 positive commands out of 613 in the Torah, and one of the 365 prohibitions out of the 613. And they are specifically to the commands of Sanhedrin, the legislation of Sanhedrin, the rabbinic law that originates with the Sanhedrin. How does that translate to today when we are without a Sanhedrin? Or let's say it in a nicer way, between Sanhedrins. Well, the Torah does not specifically command us to listen to the authoritative rulings of our rabbis. However, it is very important that we do. Now, we have a situation, I also referred to this, where it's my rabbi says this, your rabbi says that, and assuming both are rabbis in good standings with the Torah credentials, then we have a little bit of a problem, except that I follow mine, you follow yours. I do not look down my nose at you for what you're doing, you do not look down your nose at me for what I'm doing. It gets a little complicated, or let's say it better, it gets a lot complicated when we have so many different opinions and we have different kinds of present-day authorities and we have divergent streams of Judaism, we shall call them, who claim also some authority in a psak manner, in a halachic ruling. And I must say, from the Orthodox perspective, that last thing that I mentioned does not necessarily have to input into this. I don't know if that's saying it the right way. Let's put it like this. If the Torah traditional view, as expressed in our traditional sources, as reiterated by today's recognized halachic authorities, is, let's say, that prayer services in a synagogue have to separate men and women with a partition, and a legislative halachic, put that word in quotation marks, body of a movement like the conservative movement, for example, or the reform, come out with a halachic ruling on their part that it is no longer required to do that, and men and women may sit together during prayer services, then this is not what I've been talking about, of my rabbi says this and your rabbi says that. And it is not what I'm talking about by, in any stretch of the imagination, giving equal status to both of those. I will say clearly that a halachic ruling that allows men and women to sit together during prayer service in a synagogue is wrong, is not a halachic ruling has no validity in halacha and must be discounted in the minimum and fought against in the maximum, hopefully in a proper way, to preserve the sanctity of the synagogue and the sanctity of prayer service. Now, if by this statement I am picking a fight with conservative or reform, then so be it. I don't know if this particular show is, or any radio show, is the best place to pick that fight, but I need to get it on record, as far as I'm concerned, from the perspective of Torah Tidbits Audio, that just because certain people or certain groups call it a halachic committee and call their authorities rabbis does not give equal status or equal weight to their pronouncements, which very often are non-halachic or anti-halachic. Let's leave it at that. And if readers want to feed back on that, I will respond to that hopefully in future shows. But let's leave it at that for now. On that note, not necessarily the best of notes, let me wish you a Shabbat Shalom, a Chodesh Tov, and Lehishtameah.